Well, hello and welcome to another episode of the Capitol Record. We have had a number of elected officials on since we began Capitol Record, and we actually have another U.S. Senator coming up. I really enjoyed Pat Toomey last year. We have Ben Sasse coming up shortly. And today we're joined by the architect of the big Trump tax reform bill. For my mind, the best thing that got done during the Trump administration was indeed the passage of long overdue corporate tax reform. And our then head of the House Ways and Means Committee, Kevin Brady, great congressman from Texas, drove that through. Did not get nearly the credit he deserved. That's not to say Speaker Paul Ryan was not obviously very involved. There were a lot of people who contributed to the process, but Congressman Brady really did an extraordinary amount of work without the attribution I think he deserved. And he's going to join us here today on Capitol Record. We're going to talk about the economy. We're going to talk about the jobs market. And we're going to talk about the burden for economic growth. So first time guest on Capitol Record, a wonderful American patriot and public servant. We'll welcome to Capitol Record Congressman Kevin Brady. So with that said, allow me to welcome to National Review's Capitol Record, first time guest here in Capitol Record, but heralding from the Capitol himself, Congressman Kevin Brady. Congressman, thank you for joining Capitol Record.
Now, David, thanks for having me.
Well, we use this podcast week over week to make the case for a defense of free enterprise and robust capital markets, and have all sorts of guests in the realm of finance and private markets, and sometimes even theologians making the case for the morality of markets. But public policy is so integrated into these things. And I really appreciate your willingness to come talk about the impact of public policy right now into our free enterprise system. Maybe start at a high level, Congressman. What do you think, before we get into the bad stuff, is going well in the economy right now?
You know, it's been frustrating. So we've seen job growth and recovery, but it's been disappointing from the standpoint of most economists believe 2021 would be a record year because there were so many advantages heading into it. We had a much faster recovery from COVID than anyone expected under President Trump. We had trillions of stimulus dollars out there. You had life-saving vaccines and regions finally reopening. But unfortunately, we've seen some really bad economic policy. So job growth has fallen far short of what was expected. Economic growth as well. And as you know, we've seen raging inflation that's getting worse. And then we're also this crippling job worker shortage is really contributing as well to both inflation and slower growth. So it's been tough. The good news is coming into COVID, our economy was so strong. I think we recovered much quicker because of it. The bad news is because some of these policies, America has one of the highest inflation rates in the world for advanced economies like ours.
It seems to me that a lot of the kind of headline discussion on inflation and stuff that, you know, I'm on Fox News all the time and we only have a few minutes to get into it, that we don't get to unpack a lot of the nuances that we've tried to do here on this podcast. But I look at like the energy inflation as a separate subject from housing price inflation, which I think is a separate subject from goods and services, you know. Yeah. There's a lot of categories, and some of which I do think are less policy-oriented than others, and some are clearly policy-oriented. But you brought up labor shortages, and that's one where I really cannot think of a way to not put that blame on the Biden administration, that the extended unemployment last year and the ongoing transfer payments that really seem to have incentivized a more entrenched removal from the workforce, that not only to me is culturally and socially awful, but really seems to be building up the inflation pressures. Do you think that's sort of an untold story here?
Yeah, it really is. And clearly Look, there was bipartisan effort to keep people at work, connected to their work, to get them back. But the unemployment benefits were so lavish. The stimulus checks were so large, including for families where there was no interruption in their income. Then you saw in last year, the child tax credit for the first time ever was divorced from work. So that created another barrier for reconnecting to work. And then we also saw very lavish Affordable Care Act subsidies that University of Chicago estimates created better health care, jobless for about 500,000 workers than reconnecting to work. So I don't think there's any question all those policies contributed to the labor shortage. And right now, I've just not seen any interest from the administration in addressing that worker shortage. If any, in the Build Back Better, even in the slimmed down versions, they continue some of those policies.
Is there an economic disagreement with the brain trust of the Biden administration as to how labor shortages have contributed to price pressures? They can get the policy wrong, but I'm wondering if it's because there's just an ideological disagreement, or do they concede the point you're making and just maybe look at it as a cost to doing business? They view the social good as better than the inflationary bad.
Yeah, I think the answer is the second. They were very slow to deny, or they were very quick to deny there was any labor shortage. And so did the Federal Reserve, unfortunately, did that as well. They just didn't think it was real. Then they claimed it as an advantage. Look, wages are going up. It's a tight market. This is all good. But ignoring, clearly, the inflationary result when you don't have people to man the production lines, assemble the products, deliver them, or service them, you're driving inflation up in a big way. And right now, you know, what's frustrating is that, you know, people 55 and older have been flooding back into the workplace. It is that 24 to 54, sort of that prime working group we all count on, have been the slowest. About 2 million left unconnected to work. And there just doesn't seem to be any urgency by the administration on finding creative ways to reconnect them.
I know another policy that could do a really good job at getting more people out of the workforce, particularly younger and lesser skilled people, and that's an absurdly high minimum wage law, especially one legislated from Washington, D.C. What is the political calculus right now on a higher federal minimum wage? Did that die last year, or are there still colleagues of yours looking for such a thing?
You know, it is still very much on the table. We hear that, at least from the administration, on all the tax, trade, economic side of this. Raising that, imposing a $15 an hour minimum wage was estimated to cost about 3 million U.S. jobs, and really hitting hard the less skilled, the younger people trying to get into the market. Now wages have just exploded in such a way I think it's almost made minimum wage irrelevant as a political issue. But again, the White House, the president specifically this week, kept bragging on wages going up so fast, but ignoring the reports we got, which we had a rough week on the inflation side. So right now, prices are growing three times faster than paychecks. Think about that. Three times faster. And it's accelerating. The inflation is accelerating. So, you know, a family in the U.S., two workers are paying about $5,700 more today to buy the exact same products. That's pretty crushing. And then we saw on businesses, their wholesale prices are double-digit inflation, over 11%. That's going to land in higher prices as well. So I think Americans are bracing for even higher inflation ahead. I think, David, we are clearly in a wage price spiral. It's something no country wants to be in because it always ends in a recession. To end that, the Fed effectively has to raise borrowing costs higher than inflation, which at 8.5% is very harsh medicine. I think the fact that they didn't act last year and delayed really any behavior here has put them in the country in an economic pickle and a pretty rough one.
Congressman, I have a great fear about the story on the other side of the current inflation narrative. And I am a political junkie and been a right-wing, diehard movement conservative my whole life. And I do want to win elections. And I do get the benefits that the inflation story have for the right now. It's a real story. There, people are feeling it at the pump. I don't think all of this is particularly policy-driven or all of it is particularly Fed-driven. There's a lot of different complicated stories, but the real simple political story is pretty bad for President Biden and good for those, you know, on our side of the fence politically, and I get all that. But I worry about the notion that the right saying government spending is inherently inflationary will have when I think that inflation inevitably reverses back to a Japan-like stagnation that we had faced for 13 years post-crisis, and that we still sit at half of our real GDP average going back to World War II. Economic stagnation concerns me as a conservative because I want growth and prosperity for more people. And I worry that we're getting away from a growth message in only talking about the inflation side. But I admit that I probably am not being real politically savvy here. I'm just getting to the economics of it. Do you still have colleagues that are worried about economic growth and how we need to keep that supply side growth message going?
Yeah, the short answer is yes, and nearly everyone is concerned about the growth. We know what we saw after we reformed the tax code, made us more competitive, lowered those taxes, and paired that with more balanced regulation. We saw economic growth, the societal growth, especially for people of color and the lowest skilled, we saw all of that. A lot of those policies are being reversed, or at least attempted to be reversed. So there are real concerns about growth ahead. So growth is slowing. I think the chances for a recession are growing each month, unfortunately. I think part of the solution on inflation has to be to stop the COVID era programs. Don't let them get put into the budget so that they grow to unimaginable amounts later on. I do think, just as Bill Clinton won the presidency with a campaign approach of it's the economy, stupid. Right now, it's the workers, who are playing a key role here, that if we can reconnect them and create those policies, we have a chance of addressing inflation and growth at the same time. The other thing is, as long as the president keeps going after Main Street businesses and high earners, he's actually targeting those most likely, sort of the super investors into our economy. You know what I mean? They're in new ventures, investing new technology, new innovation in the supply chain. So I think if any of those policies get through, we're going to have, I think, even a more dramatic effect on growth going forward.
So you bring up the supply chain. I think I've been saying all along there's two answers that are wrong about the cause of inflation in this last year. It's those who say it's been 100% because of supply chain and those who say it's 0%. Yeah. You know, there's been some allocation or attribution in the middle there. But, the used car, new car sales at 30, 40%, as that starts to come down, it is going to bring the goods inflation component down a bit, although I think still to too high of levels. But that's been semiconductor driven. And I wonder if you just mentioned we could solve some inflation issue and growth issue all at once. What is politically feasible right now for a greater onshoring of key national security interests like semiconductors? I'm not in this kind of protectionist movement post-Trump of those who have turned on free trade. I'm a free trader. But I'm more referring right now to the specific economic necessity of getting semis onshored. Where do you think Congress can fit into some of that?
Yeah, I think broadly, we've got a real opportunity to create more reliable, resilient supply chains in a lot of things, in a lot of areas. I think key to that is having a very competitive tax code that rewards those incentives where companies can anchor, you know, those supply chains in the U.S. as they run through reliable trading partners, whether they're here in North America or others around the world. So I don't think the solution is simply dictating made in America. It is having the right economic incentives in place. And I think broader than just semiconductors. That's an industry, you know, that is well-financed, has state-of-the-art chips. Frankly, customers standing in line to buy those chips. I'm not necessarily a fan of big government subsidies for a specific industry, but I do think there are some key incentives on anchoring here in the U.S. and on innovation, which is going to be so key for the supply chains, for medicines, for agriculture and fertilizer, the greenhouse gas emissions. One of those incentives, ways and means Republicans have identified is, one, make the tax cuts permanent so there's certainty there and competitiveness. You know, double the research and development tax credits. So we're actually jump-starting more innovation all up and down the supply chain, medicines, greenhouse gas emission. It doesn't matter. We used to be, David, when we started the R&D credit in the 80s, probably ranked number one for incentives in innovation. Right now, we're 28 to 30. Other countries are super aggressive here. I think, frankly, becoming far more competitive on the innovation side would help the U.S. win that race in the future.
So you would still support an R&D tax credit in the corporate tax code?
Yeah, I would double it. I would muscle it up. You could.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Congressman. That was one of only two sort of tax credit issues you guys kept in the corporate tax reform that you spearheaded back in 2017?
Yeah, I think the R&D and, of course, you know, full and immediate expensing, whether you're small business or large, has been maybe the most pro-growth along that corporate rate cut and the new 20% small business rate cut have been, I think, the biggest bang for the buck in the code. We need to make all of those permanent, but I also think we need to be much more aggressive in innovation just because our competitors are.
Well, I certainly agree. I think you mentioned earlier, we entered the COVID moment, thank God, with a pretty strong economy. And so some of the weaknesses that the economy had to go through maybe were coupled with a little more resilience than we otherwise would have had because of some of that economic strength we had entering. Do you think that all of that is related to the 2017 tax reform? How do you kind of size up why the economy was doing well? Even not just all the political context, but overall, yeah. It really seems undeniable that there were some supply side advantages out of your tax bill that really behooved us entering COVID.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt there was a complete change in our economic trajectory, because for the full decade before, if you remember, paychecks had been stagnant, our growth was 2% or less, companies and manufacturing moving overseas, R&D, including our patents, intellectual property, locating overseas, and everyone told us that was the new normal. We knew that wasn't the case, and with a far more competitive code, and one where American companies could compete and win anywhere in the world, including here at home, their ability to bring their profits back, small businesses being able to invest, keep more of what they earn, all of that changed the trajectory in such a major way. We saw profits flowing back, investment flowing back, patents coming back, manufacturing coming back. And of course, for, you know, Asian Americans, their wages were growing 90% faster than under Obama and Biden. Hispanic Americans, 80% faster. So we saw a lot of Americans who'd been left behind in the old tax code suddenly see opportunities they didn't before. That's why our revenue has grown so quickly, record levels after tax reform. And I'm convinced that's why our economy was sort of solid on all fronts when COVID hit. And that's why we were able to recover much quicker.
I talked a lot pre-COVID about, you know, I was an overwhelming supporter of the tax reform. I hosted Secretary Mnuchin in my office, and we did a big presentation in California. I actually, by the way, am one of the few California and New York high-earning conservatives who still support getting rid of the SALT deduction, because despite the fact that my marginal tax rates went higher, I think it's good policy.
Thank you.
But the corporate side, I don't think ever got enough credit for the repatriation.
Yeah.
And the movement of, we talk about how we need more of the supply chain back on shore, but you know, we got a lot of capital back on shore, and capital formation counts for something, no matter how economically ignorant we seem determined to become as a society. How do you think we can message more the benefits of capital repatriating back to the United States?
Yeah, I have, you know, one thing back home here in Texas that people understand is when you ask them, why is a dollar sent overseas any better than a dollar invested here in the U.S.? And our tax, the old tax code created incentives to invest it somewhere else and punish you if you brought it back to the U.S. The new one did the reverse. It actually rewarded those decisions to bring that back home and to make investment decisions back in the United States. It doesn't get, I think you're absolutely right, it's gotten almost no coverage there, certainly by the mainstream media, but it played a big role in our economic growth for the long term. I think that's why those investments, as you know, are long-term investments, and they pay off over the long term. And so you've got to sway that location decision, much as Texas does, or Florida over California and in New York, and our tax code influence those location decisions in a really positive way.
Well, you're right about the perpetuity of it, that there's the immediate advantage of that repatriation, but then what is somewhat invisible in the immediate data is the ongoing investment that takes place domestically, and that people don't necessarily see, dollars that did not go to hide in an Ireland haven that otherwise maybe would have. And so that's a part of the policy that has to be understood, even if it's not readily messageable to the mainstream. Congressman, I've taken up a little bit more of your time than I told your team, but I really appreciate your comments here. Can you say anything to cheer us up about a good pro-growth agenda for the House going into 2022? I think most people believe we're going to take the House back. I want to do it by a real big margin. I know you do too. I want to see a unified party and also a unified message around first principles. And I just wonder if you have any good news for us about the state of affairs in the House for those of us that still hold on to movement conservatism.
Yeah, so I think you are going to, the good news here is the commitment to America, sort of the contract to America modernized that our Republican House is working on. It's really good stuff is the short answer here on economic growth, on security, both border, national security, issues like privacy, you know, how we drive more Main Street, small business investment and opportunity there. I really like what I see. Free market solutions on paid medical leave and retirement, encouraging rather than government solutions there. And as I told, the Ways and Means Committee has been helping develop the economic, trade, healthcare, you know, family leave types of solutions there. And I'm so excited by what I see. So what I like about this, and Leader McCarthy has been leading this charge, is, look, we probably can win back the House just on the horrible mistakes of President Biden and Nancy Pelosi. But we win leadership and a mandate if we have an agenda that works for America. And right now, it seems to me, everyone's sort of rethinking their lives, their jobs, their balance, their, you know, where they choose to live. The party that addresses that sort of great rethink, you know, and does it in a meaningful way, a free market prosperity agenda, is going to win. And so, yeah, I'm really optimistic about what I'm seeing in this agenda.
Well, I appreciate that. We always like the optimism and good news, and also just look forward to ongoing efforts to continue to have impact. Thankful. I recognize maybe more than it gets covered in the press the work you individually did on that tax reform of 2017. And I'm very appreciative, not only for the successful legislation, but for the commitment to those principles that helped drive your efforts there. So I thank you, Congressman.
Thank you, sir. It was a great team effort. I think did really great things for the country. We just can't lose that economic growth.
No. Well, we will let you go. We'll keep fighting the good fight. I thank you very much for joining us here on the Capitol Record with National Review.
David, thanks for having me. Take care, okay?
Well, I hope you enjoyed that. It's a bit shorter than we normally go because I had kind of committed to not keeping the congressman too long, and yet it was actually a bit longer than I told them it was going to be. So I hope you like what we got out of it. There is a remnant in the Congress that still cares about economic growth. Most would say they do. The remnant is smaller, by the way, of those who say they do versus those who really understand what it means. And I just happen to know Congressman Brady to be one who is well-read, who is a supply-sider, who understands incentives. I do think that there are more complicating narratives on inflation than the ones we were able to get into here today. But he's certainly right about where things stand and where it's having an impact in the economy and particularly on the job market. So I hope you got a lot out of that discussion. And we look forward to thrilling you next week with yet another wonderful guest here on Capitol Record as we continue in our ongoing journey that is the cause of a free and virtuous society. Thank you for listening to the Capitol Record.